You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. My name is Michael Silverblatt. Today my guest is Joan Didion, the author most recently of The Last Thing He Wanted. You know, I once found a sentence in the journals of Jules Renard. He says that no matter how much care one takes to write as little as possible, there will always be someone who has not read everything you have written. But I've noticed that somehow or other, I've read everything you've written, but even people I know who don't read have too. There's a way in which these works enter the popular imagination, even though I don't think they're necessarily understood once they're entered. So I wanted to talk about the newest novel, the most recent in a group that has included Play It As It Lays and Run River and A Book of Common Prayer and Democracy, to try and talk about some of its tones and themes. And I thought I'd start with the title.
The Last Thing He Wanted. It just came to me when I started the... You know, when you start a novel, you never know where it's going to go, and you're just kind of working in the dark. And I kind of thought I would write a novel in the form of a biography of a figure in Washington who had some role in events that we would learn about in the course of doing this. Now, I kind of abandoned this, but during the course of that, I just wrote down in among the notes I saw when I went back to start it again. After I abandoned that, I found in my notes, in all caps, this one phrase, "The Last Thing He Wanted." So I thought that has to be the title. Then you had to figure out who he was.
Exactly. And, yeah. And that's what interested me, because it sets out a series of resonances, because, you know, this like some kind of odd sounding device. The title blinks off and on. The last thing he wanted could be, in fact, the last thing that he wanted, desired, this particular woman. Or it could be, in that sense, the last thing I wanted was, you know, the last thing I'd want in a million years.
Yes, yes.
So it goes back and forth between dread and desire. Mm-hmm. And then the he seems to simultaneously be both this woman's father. The last thing he wanted was $1 million. Mm-hmm. And she feels sort of, well, she's sort of tender toward him because her husband has dealt in units of $100 million, and so, you know, it's almost a sentimental desire at the end of his life that her father wants $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the last thing he wanted was his daughter's death.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this strange space that the title starts to occupy, and then you notice how odd it is in a book that's narrated by one woman about another, and both of these women tend to disappear in a way.
And the two men are the stronger.
And the two men are strong.
Yeah. Stronger characters, yeah.
Were given pride of title?
Mm-hmm. Yes. You know, you can't start anything without leaving its traces on what you've finally done, no matter how many times you've changed it or thrown that out. Everything, no mark you make on paper once you've started something is not going to have some shadow in the final thing, and the title is really, and the strength of that one character, the man from Washington. Those are probably shadows, what do they call it when they look for bomb trace residue or something, of that first attempt. When it was going to be a biography of that character, Treat Morrison. The father, it comes across very strong to me because he was just one of those characters who basically I wanted him in the novel. That was a character I wanted in the novel. And so having him, I mean, the notion that he would be in the novel as Elena's father came later. He was just a character I wanted to deal with there.
Can you describe him before he was Elena's father?
His name was Dick McMahon, and he made deals. And when I say he made deals, he made little deals, very small. Small time, he could get guns. He could get stuff he provided things for all kinds of those illegal or semi-legal enterprises that go on and just on kind of the underside of our kind of the domestic underside of our foreign adventures. The characters like that came up. If you read any of the reports after the Kennedy assassination of the congressional hearings and things, there were an awful lot of characters like that who cropped up who weren't by any means necessarily involved in the Kennedy assassination, but had somehow passed through the life of somebody involved, you know, I mean, somebody of Jack Ruby, or somebody Jack Ruby knew, or somebody so-and-so knew, or somebody who had once met Lee Harvey Oswald. And they were all these kind of Dick McMahon characters, these kind of small dealers in stuff, you know. They could always get you. They could line up anything you wanted, basically, in the middle of the night on a small basis. They weren't dealing around the world. They were just dealing locally.
I noticed that Dick McMahon has a noticeably different kind of name, say, from Treat Morrison, the man in Washington, or Win Janklow. And I thought, how funny to have this book in which the men are named Win and Treat.
And I
thought to myself, how can it be that these book reviewers don't even seem to notice, you know, the tone being given to the naming of these characters, to have a woman named McMahon? Gee whiz, you know, it's not as if you're asking anyone to scale Empyrean Heights to come to see that one. And you think to yourself, well, the book is finding a way for a woman to try and adapt to all these fields of desire circumscribed by improbably named men.
Well, you never know what you're putting into a book. You know, I mean, you never think of things like names. You just know. You know when you have the right one. I knew all along that her last name would be McMahon, but I didn't know what I had real trouble with her first name, and was never very happy with it. The one thing I knew that I was fixed on was that her father would call her Allie or Ellie, which seemed to suggest that her name would be that would be obviously a diminutive of an E or an A name. But I couldn't get the right one. Allison was too fancy. Elaine was not quite right for this character of this family. Elena didn't quite have total resonance for me, but I went with it eventually, and then you kind of get stuck with it, you know.
Is that why her name changes?
That's
You just said that whatever you put on paper leaves its trace element in the book, but I tend to think, as a reader, that the books come together. I think certainly Play It As It Lay is a book that defines its title. By the time you've finished reading it, you know what Play It As It Lays means. Here, too, the title ignites a certain set of resonances which won't get answered until the end of the book. And then you begin to see the book as existing within a field defined by the title. Do you know at all what I mean?
But you don't know what that field is when you start writing it. You just have this big vacuum. Actually, I did know the title of Play It As It Lays before I started. I knew the title of this one before, you know, very early on, too. Democracy, I didn't call that. I called it Angel Visits for a long time.
Angel Visits.
Angel Visits. I had read someplace. It was an angel visit was a Victorian term for a visit of short duration, a pleasant visit of short duration. And I had thought at that time that democracy was going to be about... it was going to take place, when I started it was all going to take place at a kind of family occasion in Honolulu. It would be an American family in Honolulu who had been there since before statehood and had made a lot of money, and a lot of the family dynamic would become clear in the course of the novel, and angel visits seemed right because essentially anybody's life on earth is an angel visit, right? I guess if you think of it that way. Certainly in the life of a family, there are the people, you know, members come, they're born, they die, but the family had gone on. Then it stopped being that, and so I stopped calling it angel visits, and for a while I called it Pacific Distances. Since everybody seemed to be at a distance from everybody else. But actually, Pacific Distances was a phrase that was... it was just a phrase in our house because distances in the Pacific are so much more... if you've just been traveling in the rest of the world, and suddenly you have to fly from Honolulu to Melbourne or to Sydney, say, you have no concept of how long that takes. I mean, you can hear it, but until you are doing it, I mean, people in the Pacific think of a 10-hour flight as nothing. A 10-hour flight is
par for the course.
Yeah. So I was going to call it that for a while. Then I finished and decided to call it. And actually, John said, why don't you call it Democracy? And that sounded better. It sounded right. I mean, it seemed to... Because by then I was thinking of it as about the fall of Saigon. So you never know, as I said, you never know what the field is when you start out. And it's as if you're operating in a dream, and the dream is unfolding around you.
And yet there's a certain kind of dream it is, it seems to me. For instance... by the way, I'm speaking to my guest, Joan Didion, about her new novel, The Last Thing He Wanted. It seems to me, at least in the last three novels, that although I might not know what to call this kind of dream, that it's a dream that Joseph Conrad dreamed also, about guilt and imperialism and the beauty of a natural world being despoiled by the mere act of living in it, and a certain distance from the story required so that a narrator must narrate about still another narrator, which seems very much...
Well, I have to say that before I started each of these, I reread Victory, which, of course, has a narrator who tells a story that has been told. It's a third-hand story. It's he didn't even see the person who told him was not even present for these events. So that that distance from the story was very exciting to me somehow. I mean, it's a way of controlling the story. You know, a lot of Conrad is very exciting to me. I mean, the landscape. I mean, the physical settings, the physical setting with which Victory opens with the picture of Axel Heist on the dock there. You know, and well, you're there.
And not to mention the way in which, well, actually to mention the way in which the things are simultaneously funny and ominous.
Mm-hmm.
And in The Secret Agent, it seems just studded mm-hmm. with a player piano that erupts into mm-hmm. song. And mm-hmm. there's a strange trade office, I think, in The Heart of Darkness
mm-hmm.
with three women who are not businesswomen at all. They're knitting. They're the Fates.
Mm-hmm.
But only Conrad would dare
mm-hmm.
to make something
mm-hmm.
as exciting and funny and
mm-hmm.
frightening.
Mm-hmm. The relationship between Axel Heist and Lena, which we are never close to, but it's very, very romantic in some way. I mean, it's so deeply. I see as I talk to you that it is basically the beginning of the dream of what happens to Elena in this book. I mean, that it's a very similar kind of romance. I mean, that was the germ of it.
Well, the project, if it can be called that, of the novel at that time seems very reanimated by your work. By the project of the novel at that time, I mean, it seems to me that Conrad, that Ford Madox Ford, that even Kipling and certainly James are examining point of view
mm-hmm.
in the most relentless way imaginable. That to understand these books really, you have to consider who has said what to whom, when, what did they know when they were told, what did the teller know?
What does the teller know? I mean, that's a great question in The Good Soldier, is what did the teller, I mean, who is that teller? I mean, you never get the straight, you never look at it straight in The Good Soldier. And that's exactly, they were doing that, and that was a huge preoccupation of James's, wasn't it?
Yeah. Enormous.
Yeah.
Enormous. And here, you know, it's very interesting to me because I feel that although your novels have been caught in the fever of public moments and tend to be celebrated, that they are classical in this way of investigating what a novel can do in the process of what it does do, which is to tell.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if that particular group of people at that particular time, if in a way they were trying, that they were the first people to really, with the novel, use the novel to try to get close to human personality, human character. To some extent before that, novels had been
adventures.
They had been picaresque tales or great pictures of a society, even with useful ways in which amusing accounts of how people rose from one class to another, or unamusing accounts of how they fell. They had been very fixed in a fixed class structure, and as fixed class structure started to fall apart at a certain point late in the 19th century, maybe that's what threw up this group of people who were trying, this group of novelists who were trying to get, who were taking the novel to look at personality. There's a thing that Joyce Carol Oates put in the beginning of one of her novels. I think it was the beginning. It was the epigraph at the beginning, or the dedication. I think it was "Do with me what you will." But the dedication was, for all of us who pursue the shifting phantasmagoria of personality. And that seemed very moving to me.
I'm glad that you bring up that book in particular.
Do with me what you will.
Yes.
It's a fantastic book.
Fantastic book.
You know, when I was reading it, a lot of Joyce Carol Oates affects me this way. Unlike anybody except Dreiser, really. You become part of the novel. You are in the novel for the length of time you're reading it. I happened to be reading it. We were living in Malibu, and we had to go to dinner up the beach, and I can remember dragging myself away from the book to get dressed to go to dinner. And when we got to dinner and I was sitting, this is dinner at the beach, you know. I'm sitting and I have a drink, and suddenly I look down at what I'm wearing. I have dressed myself for this evening at the beach in a beige velvet skirt that happens to be lined with pale blue satin. And have it has a pale blue satin sash. Now, I don't even know what corner of my closet I had dragged this from, but as if I were still in the dream, I had dressed myself as the wife of a trial lawyer, because, of course, it's about the wife of a trial lawyer.
But what becomes so interesting to me in that book, several books do this of Joyce Oates's at that period, because she is exploring identity, she puts at the center a woman who has become a blank.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If I remember correctly, that woman has been kidnapped by her father from the schoolyard.
Right.
And one day he disappears and never comes out of a movie theater.
But before that, they are living there in hiding. There's just a horrendous hiding experience.
All I can remember is that she eats raw spaghetti, mm-hmm. and she comes out looking very thin and beautiful as a model,
mm-hmm.
and that this is the last time you get a shred of personality from her. From the rest of the time, she's looking for herself in the mirror. She's mm-hmm. She's having autoscopic hallucinations.
Mm-hmm.
The self is vanishing on her mm-hmm. left and right. And I think that for you too, the self is examined from the perspective of its potential vanishing or absence. Does that have any resonance
yeah.
for you?
Well, I guess all of us, I mean, if you have any sense of mortality, the actual vanishing of self is if it is that easy, then where is the self?
It's only easy in art.
Well, no, I mean, it's easy in life. You know, suddenly you could cross the street, you could die, people die off, in ways in which they might not have expected when they got up that morning. So I think that's, if you were a fearful child of no faith, you grow up with an uncertain sense of your own, the survival of your own personality in the world.
I've often thought, and perhaps this is a thoroughly ungentlemanly thing, that again and again in the Joyce Carol Oates novels, there is almost an obligation, a duty, to reinvent the abusive father. And once he is there, the book can be written
mm-hmm.
because it has a center of fascination and
mm-hmm.
gravity.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have anything to say about the elements of a writer's work that must be repeated from book to book? They seem to be sine qua nons for the imagination. Their values may differ, their meanings from novel to novel, but almost talismanic. Certain elements need to be aligned for an imaginative act to occur.
Well, I think that, you know, I think certainly I see when I'm finished with something, I see that it has parallels or that there are certain elements that I've used before. But I try not to think about it too much because I'm afraid if I analyze it too much, they'll go away and my ability to do it again will be
But they
will
can't
vanish.
Go away.
Well, it, you know, it's such a chancy thing getting up in the morning and doing it.
If nothing one has ever done in one's life has been able to move these things a fraction of an inch, intellection seems least capable.
Yeah, you're probably right. But, I mean, I one thing I do know is that I tend not to. My interest in writing about something that doesn't take place in very warm weather is low. And certainly there is always, has always been a woman in my books who is in some sort of extreme circumstance. She is in some sort of distress. That is what happens, and at the end of each of them, it seems to me, although not to every reader, that she emerges dead or alive, stronger, having become more, in the course of the book, more honest, having shed certain delusions. Those are the things that I do see repeated in my own. In my own work, I was just trying to think whether there was an abusive father in We Were the Mulvaneys, but I can't remember. There is he's a strange father. Yeah,
he's sometimes young. Sometimes the character goes on a date with him, but there'll always be something that reveals, in fact, that he's the father.
Mm-hmm.
If he comes for a date, it will turn out that his luxurious hair is, in fact, a toupee. There's always some sign that the father's showing up again. Here he is, you know. I've been speaking to Joan Didion on the occasion of the publication of The Last Thing He Wanted, published by Knopf. Thank you for joining me.
I'm glad to be here.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Jennifer Swadek. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica.
Books can be funny too.
Laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.